birthday conference for Bill, and thank you to Silke for inviting me to present something. When she invited me, I was a little bit worried because although I did work with Bill some years ago, I knew that most of the people here would be from the GR field, and I've moved to do something which is a little bit different in quantum information and doing some experiments. So I was wondering, what will I tell you something? What will I tell you which could interest you? So decided to take Bill as the theme, and then so we'll talk about things that Bill has done and influenced in the work that I've done. It's great, in fact, for me to meet some of my old colleagues of the GR field. In fact, I think I haven't seen Bob for 25 years or something like this. So to have this occasion, so Bill has been the catalyst to make this happen. About the subject also, I realized that when Bob this morning talked about information loss, I realized that he was talking about information loss from a theoretical point of view. I'm going to talk about trying not to get information loss from an experimental point of view. So I don't know why is the problem about information loss, because when I go to the lab, there's always information loss. We never see unitary transformation. These unitary transformations are a fiction of people's imagination, and they're happy with this, but in the lab, it's okay to have some of that loss. Then I heard Jonathan open up. Oh, the mic. Then I heard Jonathan talk about quantum thermodynamics, and a little piece of work that I will talk about is related to algorithmic cooling. How do you cool system? I'll think about it from a quantum information processing point of view, and you'll see, you'll hear a little bit more about that. And then Stephen, a few minutes ago, talked about prophets and heretics. And I'll come back to this and a comment related to Bill. So on Tuesday night, I had dinner with Bill and Pat, and I tried to remember when was the first time I met Bill. And Bill, so we both remember we were on a boat on the Halifax Harbor where Bill gave me a few pieces of advice. One of them was, don't believe everything your supervisor tells you. And he didn't know by then that at some point it would be my supervisor. So there was his own risk.
It was especially true of that one.
And he also told me that he was always interested in getting good students. So I went back to look when was the time there was a Canadian Association of Physics conference in Halifax. And there was one in 1982. I don't remember it, I've gone to the conference, but I do remember it, I've seen Bill on the boat. So don't know exactly how it happened. So I went and do a little bit of forensic. I'm moving house at present, which means you move your old boxes that I've moved from Cambridge to Vancouver, back to Cambridge, to Los Alamos, to Waterloo, that has never been opened, but I opened a few, and I found that letter. I had written to Bill in 1983 to become a student. And he says, oh, I enclose a few papers on what it does. And he says, regarding the possibility of studying with me, I must first say that I will be on sabbatical this next year. So in addition, I have a number of students inquired possibility, and then I'll be somewhat selective in choosing my students. So I realized that I would not be able to work with Stephen. So I just went somewhere else. Turns out that Bill went to Cambridge. I seem to have followed him there. And then I tried to work really hard so that when I would become a postdoc, with this high criteria of selectivity, I could fit there. So I spent a few years in Cambridge, and then I went to work with Bill and from 98 to 1990. At that time, I did quantum cosmology. I did also some astrophysics. But around 1994, I had learned some things about quantum decoherence from Bill. And suddenly, there's a conference I went to and on in Santa Fe on the physics of information. And Bill was there, I was there, and there was a computer scientist, Umesh Vazarini, who gave a talk. And I remember he started the talk by saying, I'm not gonna talk about things I'm doing right now because it's not that interesting, which takes quite a lot of guts of saying this in front of smart people. He says, there's a really neat problem I've heard about that has been solved by this guy called Peter Shor. How to factor numbers with a quantum computer. I'd worked a little bit with Seth Lord, or I went hiking with Seth Lord, who had been working on quantum computers, so I knew a little bit about what they were. Umesh talked about how to factor. I didn't know what was the interest. And for the few of you who don't know why the importance of
factoring is related to cryptography. So if you use the internet today, you've used that problem to encrypt your information without really knowing it. And there was this buzz at the conference that this was something interesting. And I went back to Los Alamos, Bill went back to UBC, and it was pretty clear for people who knew about decoherence that decoherence was going to be a problem for quantum computers. And so I started to play with a little toy model to show that quantum computers would not work. And one day I look at the archive and I see a paper by Bill showing exactly this. So gut scoop. But so this was a great thing because Bill really showed that decoherence was a real problem. And if people were dreaming about quantum computers would get into trouble. But there's one thing that I've learned being a postdoc of Bill in part of his mentorship. And all of you who have kind of interacted with Bill, either at the conference or kind of in discussion, you know that Bill likes to argue. And as a postdoc of Bill, sometimes it was a little bit hard. Certainly coming from Cambridge, where my supervisor didn't argue at the same pace. It was a little bit slower with my PhD supervisor to argue and get the answer back. But Bill really loved to argue. And then after a while, at the beginning, I was a little bit intimidated. And if you look at Bill's physics and mine, a little bit different also. So the first few times I was arguing with Bill, I felt that I had this grizzly bear in front of me looking down. So one day I'm arguing with Bill, and he's there, kind of passionate. So I get like this, and I look at Bill, and Bill says, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "I'm arguing with you." And then he burst laughing. And I think that's probably the only time I got the argument on my side with Bill. But then I got a little bit smarter, because what I've learned from Bill is that in any arguments, there's two sides of the coin. And if I wanted, if I would argue, I would start with white with Bill, he would go to black and argue on the side, try to put all the arguments. So after a few months arguing with Bill, I realized that if I wanted to convince him of white, I would start with black. And then he would go on and then I'd argue. And then I would say, "Exactly, Bill, you have exactly the point." And it turns out that lesson was very important. And I'll come back to this in a few seconds. So I'm going to talk about how to not lose information and a bunch of two-level system, which we call qubits in my field, and how do we try to protect the information in such a way that quantum information processing devices are robust. But before I go this, maybe I should ask, how many of you are quantum information guys or girls in here? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so for the others, stop me anytime if I do or say something that doesn't really make sense. Part of my talk will be a little bit on general things, some of them, or I'll be very specific on things that I've done. So you have a mix of the two, and you can choose which one are the most fun. So what is the goal of quantum information processing? Is to find a system on which you know the wave function to start with. And then you evolve it in the Hilbert space, and you end up to another wave function, which contains the answer of a calculation you want to do, or a set of bits which have a key for an encryption, or it sends some devices which you can learn about some environment and do something. And you try to do this by manipulating the Hamiltonian. And from that point of view, it doesn't seem to be that different when doing any problem in quantum mechanics. Now, what we've learned in quantum information, if you try to think about computation in particular, is that as you increase the number of these quantum bits of two-level system that you have, it becomes typically exponentially hard to control this Hamiltonian to get to the right place where we are. And if it's exponentially hard, exponential catch you very quickly. And I'll give an example in a few minutes of how quickly an exponential catch you. And so despite this fact, so people started to think about, can we solve problem? And the fact that we have bits of information in superposition for a certain type of problem, it seems to be helpful. So we've discovered that there are families of algorithms which helps you to serve some problem, simulation of quantum physics, factoring, finding some, searching some kind of database, or some other computer science problems. So at least there's a reason of why people would be interested to go into this. We've also described a different language, the thing about quantum mechanics. So certainly all the time I was undergrad and the time of grad and then beginning of my postdoc years, I would think about quantum mechanics in this way. Computer scientists think about programming in a way where you have quantum bits in the y-axis, time in this axis, and then they make little blobs like this. And this kind of is a way to encapsulate this. And what they've shown is that if you can do a generic rotation of each of the qubits, okay, rotated generally from one place to the other, and then you have an interaction between two of these quantum bits, then you can generate any kind of unitary transformation that you want. Some of them will be not efficient. That'll take a lot of gates to get the right unitary transformation. But there are some where you can do efficiently, which can solve some problem. So think about this becomes important or interesting because you start to think about quantum mechanics slightly different way, which has helped the idea of how to control these Hamiltonian. And this is one of the things I was going to mention. It's a discovery of how to control quantum system in a robust way. And again, I should say, in a scalable way also. So in principle, we know how to control the Hamiltonian just by having your physical device, which we represent the right Hamiltonian. But we don't know, we didn't know how to do this in a scalable way up to the end of the 1990s. And this is the theory of quantum error correction. How, when you don't have full precision, how do you go and control the system? I should say one more piece in there is we have proof of concept of some of experiments. So this is not only theory, we can have a few quantum bits, up to about a dozen. And if you tell me I want to have this wave function as a final state and starting from that one, and you give me certain gates, then you can go to the lab and doing this. And for the last 10 to 15 years, I've been doing some of this. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about some piece of a quantum error correction called benchmarking gates. How do we know that we do gates at a certain precision? Example of implementation of quantum error correction, algorithmic cooling I mentioned, maybe a little bit of magic state distillation if I have time, then I'll conclude. So at the end of the conference that I mentioned, and there were a few people who were really skeptical about the idea of building quantum computers. I mentioned about prophets or heretics, then you can decide if the two people here were prophets or they were heretics. We don't have quantum computers which can solve problems we cannot solve with classical computers today. So maybe they are prophets of dooms, or maybe they were just heretics in today's fashion of having a quantum computing institute around the world. So Rolf Landauer was very, very critical. In fact, maybe he was some kind of cousin of, scientific cousin of Bill. So Rolf really liked to argue. So here's one of his quotes in one of his papers. Talking about quantum computing, we've essentially returned to an analog computer as already foreseen by Paris in a remarkably perceptive comments made in 1985. And if you know a little bit about computer science, you know that if you have analog devices, they are much harder to control. We don't know how to control them in a scalable way. And if you think about quantum mechanics as quantum computing as moving a wave function in a continuous way, it seems that there's no way. And it was the intuition of most physicists pre-1995 that this would be impossible to do, impossible to control. Now, here's one, which is also another quote from Landauer. Unfortunately, we continue to see contribution to quantum parallelism, which are correct and imaginative in their details. And for Rolf Landauer, saying a comment that it's correct and imaginative, this is a really nice compliment that he was doing to the community. But he says, but do not even mention the need to control tolerances and noise. In some cases, the literature goes even farther and simply describes the quantum mechanical mapping from state to state. So the little diagram I gave you a little bit, like he was complaining about this. And without specifying an apparatus needed to do that. Well, it's okay to do theoretical computer science and understanding algorithm. But the talk today is talking about this control of tolerances and noise. So we're going to address this. Now there's a paper by Bill, which had kind of argument also that decoherence, the fact that if your system is not isolated, the off-diagonal terms of the density matrix are gonna shrink, and this affects quantum computation, and the exponential power that certain algorithm would have if we don't have decoherence would be decimated by decoherence. That was the main idea of Bill. Now, here's the place where the mentorship of Bill has been using. He likes to look at the different side of the coin. I get this paper, I'm really mad, because I thought, okay, maybe I would be able to write something on this. Maybe I can take the other side of it. So I look at Bill's paper, and I try to, intellectually, rip it apart, and try to find mistakes in it, and find things that would not work. And so that's what I started to do in 1995, not being totally sure if it is going to work. Now, there was a few trivial places where I could say, yeah, he's probably not right. But Bill, I knew, would come back and says, oh, no, this doesn't matter too much. Think about the scalability. Things are long-term of kind of doing a quantum programming. So somewhere in this paper, he says, but the time taken in the quantum calculation must be less than the thermal time scale H bar over KBT. So at room temperature, what is the time corresponding to H bar KBT? About nanoseconds. So you realize that you have to do your quantum computation in nanoseconds. So it has to be pretty fast. And if you look at technology today, oh, it's going to be hard to have a system which can follow this. But I learned a little bit about nuclear magnetic resonance. You do things with nuclear spins in water is about like this. The decoherence time is about a second. You're at room temperature. And you can have a occurrence that is about 10 or 9 orders of magnitude larger than this. So maybe there's a little bit of hope. But I came from cosmology. So 1, 2, 3 sort of magnitude you can cope with. But 9, I thought, was kind of, there should be something in there. And in fact, if you do something where, like, you're heating your system, the decoherence time increases, which seems to be a little bit of contradiction of what you would get just by this simple problem. In fact, it increases because the decoherence coming for the coupling with the spin around, and the molecules are tumbling very fast. And the decoherence comes from the fact that they don't average the Hamiltonian from the environment. But if you heat your liquid a little bit, you make them tumble a little bit faster, so it averages a little bit better, and there's a little bit less decoherence. So maybe there's some weird way of controlling quantum system. So I started to work on this and to find ways. And T2. Well, the T1, at some point you will hit the solids or the gas and then goes apart. So depending on the interaction or anything. But the T2 is the one which is with the dipole interaction with the nearby nuclei of different molecules. So I started to work on this and stumbled onto some interesting. I had a postdoc with whom I work, Ike Chuang, with whom we discovered how to detect error instead of correcting error. Now, not perfect, but at least you knew if you had the right result. But we had two great people in the field, Peter Shore and Andrew Steen, who found ways to correct errors. And so if you want to do quantum error correction, you need a few things. You need to understand the noise of your quantum system. And for classical bits, the noise is bit flips. 0 is going to 1, 1 going to 0. So what is the noise for quantum system? Well, if things are, let's assume that we have a state of this form, and then you get a little bit of a phase here that comes from interaction with another system. And it turns out that you can rewrite this in this form. Plus half and if you write it that form, you say, oh, this is my state that I started with other phi, with the unit operation. I haven't done anything to it. But in the part here, this is z times the state. So you can think about this, nothing happens. And here you have a phase flip, totally of pi by itself. So this becomes discrete. And so not only you have the x errors, the sigma x errors, which flips the bits, like the classical system that can have on top of whatever. But you also have sigma z error. And if you look at one quantum bit, well, you have 3 Pauli matrices. and you have the sum of the two, which is the y. So you have three types of error. But this one is the combination of those two. So for one quantum bit, you can think about two types of error, the classical errors and the quantum errors, or the phase errors. And interestingly, it's that way. And you remember quantum mechanics is linear. So if you correct for this and you correct for this, you correct for a combination of both of them, and then it can occur at different rates. So from this, you could understand noise in a discrete way. And what these guys discovered is that we could reverse the effect of the noise if you take your quantum bit and encode it in a larger quantum system. And the way you do this is by ensuring that the way you encode it, that you don't lose any information. That is, the different types of noise, X or Z, sends you to different parts of the Hilbert space. And so you can find which errors happen without knowing which message happened. From this, you can define some encoded state. We'll call them 0 and 1 L. L is logical or encoded. And so these one we'll call. And if you have this conditions, these are noise operator. If they remain orthogonal under the effect of the noise, you can always distinguish after and before the noise, so you can reverse that effect. And then when you have I and J equal to the same thing happened to the zeros, the same thing as happened to one, so the current is preserved. And if you have this equation, then you can. And so if you have noise which is mild enough, you cannot do this for any type of noise, but you can do this for some type of noise, and the question is, are they reasonable? I'll come back to this. Now, if you have an error-correcting code, it's one step towards making quantum information processor robust. You also want to know what happens when you try to do error correction. Do you induce more errors by trying to correct or not? And this is encapsulated in a theorem called the accuracy threshold theorem, saying, yes, it is possible to do this as long as the error rate is small enough. And you can do this with an amount of resources, that is extra qubit, extra gate, which does not go too fast with the size of the problem you want to solve. So you have a scale in the problem. I mentioned factoring. So factoring, the scale is the number of digits you want to factor. And you say how much extra resources you need to do error correction. And if you think like a computer scientist, there's two class of possibility, exponential or polynomial. If exponential, you're in trouble. It's impossible to do quantum computation. If it's polynomial, you've really gained. And what people have shown is that you can do this with an amount of resources, which is polynomial. And so that's quite interesting. It tells you that you can control quantum system in a scalable way. And so imperfection, imprecision of realistic devices are not a fundamental objection. But there is a value of a threshold, and if you have really good eyes, you'll see the value of this threshold in here. But I've put it in a fuzzy way enough because we don't really know what's the value of the threshold, because to know the threshold, you need to know exactly what is the physical implementation that you have, what is exactly the code that you're using. And so by doing all of this, it's a constructive proof. And by changing little details here or there, you can change the value. But the typical, if we would get a threshold value, which would be 10 to the minus 20, even if you have some really good qubits, you probably have to give up your hands. You'll be out there or that way. If the threshold would be 10 to the minus 1, we'd probably have quantum computers today, and I wouldn't be here because we'd be doing something else. The thresholds that we have are 10 to the minus 6, 5, 4, 3, depending on the type of code that people have and the assumption that people are doing. So reasonable value of threshold, and when some of these theorems were proved, around 1996, 7, or 8, people had values of threshold which were 10 to the minus 5, and some experimentalists would say, this is going to be incredibly, incredibly hard, because at the time, people started to do operation with quantum bits, and the error rate was maybe 1 or 2% for single-qubit gate and about 10% for two-qubit gate. So they could show, they could have a little bit of coherence to say, these ideas are not totally crazy. But today, we have things which are better, and I'll come back in a few minutes about
that. Units for 10? I mean, what does that mean exactly?
So you mean when I say 10 minus 6? It's very pale. 10 minus 6, minus 5, minus 4, minus 3.
That's a probability.
Yeah, it is. What is the probability that, let's say that one of these error comes into one of your qubit?
But what about, you mentioned in passing that you can only correct for certain types of noise.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, what about the other types of noise? And what about the rate at which that other type of noise occurs?
There will always be some noise that you will not be able to correct. And this is not different between the classical world and the quantum world. There are devices that you just do not use for information processing. That's it. You don't use for information processing. So you have to look for systems which are have a certain set of properties. And we hope that we will find these properties, which, in fact, leads me to the next things. What are the assumptions of this? And here, knowledge of the noise or what type of noise. And so the work that I've been doing for the last 10 years, 15 years, is to really understand, are the assumptions of this accuracy threshold theorem realistic or not? And can we implement some steps towards quantum error correction in physical devices? And again, influence of Bill, of thinking about the assumption and then being critical about, is this going to work or not? So example of assumption, parallel operation. If you cannot talk to your qubits in parallel and you have a fixed error rate, at some point the error is going to kill you because you'll increase the number of qubits and then there'll be one which will flip that you won't have the time to correct before it goes. You need to have good quantum control and good control the quantitative value of this is the value of the threshold that I had before. We have to have the ability to extract entropy. You can think about quantum error correction or classical error correction as being inside of a fridge. There's noise that comes in, and you have some insulating devices that kind of catch the heat before it comes to your system and kind of throw it away. You need to be able to do this. And as I just mentioned, knowledge of the noise. So right now, when we do this theorem, most of the time we assume that we have a set of qubits. Okay, and on these qubits, the error is independent from qubit to qubit, and the noise is to apply x, z, or y at the same rate. Now, when you go to do physics in the lab, they don't happen at the same rate, but there's way you can randomize them so that they look the same, or you have a code that if they correct for this and this independently, they'll correct for the other one. And doesn't matter which rate they are. So that's a really benign difference. If you start to have correlation between this, then it becomes troublesome. For example, if your bits, they all flip at the same time, then your error code is not going to work. So example of this that you might know about, if you look at the CD, at least for the older people, the younger people here probably have never seen a CD because they just do MP3s on their iPhone, but for the old people, and I'm not talking about LPs, I'm talking about CDs. The LPs are analog and they make this funny noise. CDs have really kind of large error correcting codes in them so that you can use them when you move around and do certain things. So if you take a CD and you make a scratch, which is radial, and you put it in your CD player, you won't hear it, because the code is really good, it kind of has the redundancy around. But if you make a scratch which is singular, then this doesn't work. Why do they do this like this? Because if you take your CD and put it on the table, take it out, most of the scratch will be radial and not kind of much harder to do a scratch which goes the other way. In fact, you go a little bit further, you can take a CD, you can take a little pin, you gotta put a hole in it, and you put it near the CD machine, and you don't hear. So it's different than LLP, where you would hear a little pop kind of going from one place to another. Bob is laughing, which is good, same generation as me. The other guys had no idea, the younger guys, what we mean by this. But same thing here with quantum error correction. Depending on what kind of the noise that you have, some of them will not be correctable. And it's always possible to find a noise which is not correctable. So you cannot correct for all noise. You hope that nature is kind and gentle enough. And then the systems that we do see today for quantum information processing, it seems that the noise is quite reasonable. Same thing for classical computation. When you have a lightning hitting your computer, doesn't help. You're not protected, or sometimes you have a power burst thing, so you have added a piece of error correction, but if you don't, then it burns. Sometimes it fails. The last thing that you need, and I'm looking at time, and I'm gonna run out of time, but I can stop any. I don't need to go through all my slides. We need quite a lot of qubits. By lot, it's an experimentalist talking about. Computer scientists will say, it's polynomial. You don't have to worry about it. In the lab, lots means anything above 10. So here's a graph of qubits as a function of time. So this is a time, 1985, 95, 2000, 2005, 10, 2015. Number of qubits, 14. So different types of technology, NMR, the kind of things that I work, I'll start in here, photons and different little words here is different type of things that people have done. Point here is that today we have about a dozen of quantum bits that people can manipulate. So dozen is about the limit, but if you have superconducting qubits or photon with 3 qubits, you can have really good precision, you can control this. If you take as a benchmark, if undergrad can do this in the lab, it's easy, then you do with a few qubits, people can do this. It's only with an MR, they can do this in a couple of days. And ion trap, harder, superconducting qubits, maybe. The second progress that we've seen in the last 10 years is the accuracy at which we can do some gates. Now, we'll talk about benchmarking, we'll come back to this, but the point is, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, a few percent error for 1-qubit gates, 10% error for 2-qubit gates was the best. And today we can go to 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, maybe 10 to the minus 5. So, and cool progress and ability of controlling very small quantum system, but with very high quality. So we can do 1,000 gates with an MR without too much work. Okay, now there I go on quantum computation. I mentioned to you that when we think about quantum computation, we think about making gates. And I told you that if we have a generic 1-qubit gate, so it's a block sphere, you rotate around this block sphere in a generic way, it can be generated with what is called an Hadamard gate and a phase gate if you want to use discrete system. And then a 1-to-qubit gate, a control not gate is, if the control bit is 0, it doesn't do anything to the target bit. If it's 1, it flips it. And if you combine both of them, it becomes what we call universal. You can build any unitary transformation. But a system is not complete if you don't say which states you start with, because you can hide the difficulty of doing something. So we'll assume that we always start with a 0 state. And then you measure in some basis also. You cannot go and hide the difficulty of doing something by having a really complicated measurement. Now it turns out that when you start, so if you do a first course of quantum information as an undergrad, they will give you this. But on the second day or third day, when they start to talk about error correction, people start to change things, in part because we know how to make these gates robust with certain families of codes. And we use gates which are called transversal. That is, if you have one encoded qubit to interact with one encoded qubit to do an encoded control knot, we want to have 1 qubit here that doesn't interact with one more than 1 qubit on the second. Because if you have one which interact here, and then let's say this one would interact from there to there, one error here could propagate to 2 error here. And if you have a code which corrects for only 1 error, then you would propagate error in such a way that it'll be uncontrollable. So these gates called transversal and are ways which are well behaved, okay? We know how to do this with the control knot. We know how to do this to a few of these 1-qubit gates, but we don't have a universal set of transversal 1-qubit gate. So people started to think about a different way of thinking about quantum computation, which is a little bit different now than what we would think classically. We're going to limit ourselves to the 1-qubit gates, only the one where we have these transversal construction. So we have transversal gate in here, example of these gates, and control knot. And they are part of what is called the Clifford group. The Clifford group is the group which preserves the tensor product of Pauli matrices. So if I have a tensor product of Pauli matrices, I apply this unitary transformation, I'll have another tensor product of Pauli matrices, but I won't have a sum of those. And it turns out that with this, we can make this robust from a quantum error correction point of view, but it's not universal. And it turns out that everything that you can do with this, you can simulate it efficiently classically. Now, that's quite an interesting piece. With these gates in control knots, you can make very, very entangled gates. But when you look at the statistics at the end of how many zeros and one for the first, second, and third qubit, you can calculate this efficiently in classical means. To make this universal, you need one other type of state, and which is called the magic state, and I'll might mention a little bit further what it is. And there's a state in the Bloch sphere, which is equidistant between the x, y, and z axis. So we have the Bloch sphere. Where the one state is at the bottom, state at the North Pole. This is x, y, and z direction. And so the one which goes straight between x, y, and z, if we can prepare that state, we can use it as another input. And with this, you can compute in a universal way. So you use a state to make gates, which complete this set of gates. And we know how to deal with this in a way which is reliable. That is, if there are errors in there, you can find ways to make to control them. Okay. First type of things that we have been interested in is, I mentioned that we need to know what the noise is. Well, how do we know what the noise is? Let's make a simple assumption that your environment and your system starts in a state which are tensor product between each other. So that is the extra correlation are in degree freedoms which will not interact with your system anymore. That's the assumption. In reality, this is not totally true, but in practice, it's a good place to start. The Jernig evolution is not a unitary transformation on the row anymore, but a sum of operators called cross operators. So we can do this, and we're going to write this in this form here, with what is called the chi matrix. So we expand these things in terms of Pauli operators, tensor product of Pauli operators. So we can write this way. You'll see next transparency why I write this way. Now the problem is that if you look at this matrix and you see how many entries are there in there, it goes like 4 to the 2n for n quantum bits. So if you want to describe the Jernig evolution with this assumption here of started with separable things, how many pieces of data do you need? 4 to the power 2n. If you're an experimentalist, I go and say, okay, for one qubit, it's about 16. So it turns out that there's minus something because it has to be trace preserving, but the minus goes only like 4 to the n. So for one qubit, you need 12 parameters to describe the Jernig evolution. For two qubits, it's something like 60. And then you go to three qubits, it's like a few thousand or about 4,000. Four qubits, it's a few hundred thousand, which means you need a few hundred thousand experiments at least to describe the evolution of four qubits. So you know you'll never know what is the exact noise of your quantum system. So how do you do error correction? So when you want to do error correction, I mentioned to you, you want to know what is the probability of X, Y, or Z. Or even if you randomize them, the same probability of X, Y, and Z, you say, what is the probability of zero errors? What is the probability of one error? It doesn't depend which qubit is affected. What is the probability of two errors? What is the probability of three errors? Can you get this? Well, definitely, if you have this whole matrix, you can add all these pieces. But this is really inefficient. Is there a way to symmetrize the noise in order to do this? And the answer is, yes, you can do it. I'm not going to go in detail except to say what you're doing is you're going to do an experiment where you're going to rotate your qubits in a specific way, so it randomizes the noise so that the only numbers that comes out to the end is this probability of zero errors, one error, and two errors. And you average over which group? It turns out that it is this Clifford group that comes in. It is the product of the Pauli group and the symplectic group. And what does the Pauli group does is that it kills the off-diagonal terms of this chi matrix, the symplectic group, what it does is that it averaged the error so that x, y, and z happens at the same rate. And with this, then you can get a very few set of numbers, which you can go and calculate in the experiments. And here's the protocol of the experiments. Start with 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Take your qubits and shuffle them so that you symmetrize them. Apply this Clifford group. Let the noise happen. There is the assumption here that you can do this reliably with very little noise. This is reasonable if the noise is kind of low enough. Then you do the conjugate of the Clifford group, symmetrizing again. And then what you'll see is that the only error that happens is some XYZs. Sometimes they happen in pair for qubit 1 and qubit 3, and sometimes many more of those. And you go and measure how many of these bits have flipped. And you do this again. You do this again. And you find the statistics of how often nothing happens. It will give you the probability of zero errors. You'll go and calculate what is the probability of having one bit as flipped, the probability of one error, and same for two or three. And this, you can do this with an amount of resources that doesn't grow exponentially. And this gives you a characterization to use certain types of error correcting code. So I mentioned that we're doing experiments. Again, I'm looking at the time, so I'm going to just explain a few things on one type of experiments that that we've been doing. We look at nuclear spins of carbon-13 in a molecule which is called malonic acid. So it has three carbon-13, two hydrogen here, one there, and one there. Those ones are far away from these three, which will be our three qubits here. So we don't worry too much about them. And then so what we do here is in a solid. So we take these molecules and we synthesize them with carbon-13 and another group with carbon-12 only. And then we mix them together, we make a crystal, and we make a crystal such that the one with the carbon-13 are far away from each other so that they don't talk, the dipole-dipole interaction is very weak. Okay? So the other molecules here have carbon-12. Carbon-12 doesn't have a spin, so we don't see any of those. And there's some hydrogens kind of that sticks out. And so it turns out that the magnetic moment of the hydrogen is very different from the carbon. So we can send radio frequency pulse with a coil that contains all that sample that makes the hydrogen rotate very fast. If it rotates faster than the dipole-dipole interaction, they disappear. They don't interact with your system. You don't have to worry about them. So we're left with the ones with the carbon-13. And this, we can measure them. We put them far apart from each other so that they don't talk to each other, so they are kind of little islands. We need many of them because the way we observe is we stop sending pulse in that big coil. And then when there are nuclear spins in here, they're going to rotate. We're going to induce a current in that coil. You go and measure this, you Fourier transform, you see little peaks, and depending on the shape of the peaks, the height, all this, you know what is the state of the system. So with this, we can go and do these experiments. We can control them. Should have mentioned also that although we have three carbons here, if you put them in the magnetic field in a way that which is not symmetric with the background magnetic field, then you get a different armor frequency for each of these three carbons. So again, we can pulse at the frequency which is there, or there, or there. So we can talk to our qubits one by one. And then the gates between these two is the dipole-dipole interaction between them. So once we know this, we know the Hamiltonian, we can control them, we can go into the experiment. We do similar type of experiments to characterize the noise with larger molecule. This one is a molecule which is in the liquid instead of a solid, but the same kind of principle ideas. We have 7 carbon, 5 hydrogen, so this is our 12-qubit system, and we are doing this characterization of noise in that part of the system. Okay. Not only we can characterize the noise, but we can also characterize how good are we at making gates. So we do the same protocol that we had, where instead of doing nothing, what we had before, and just the noise, we can think about adding one of these Clifford gates that we had before, or that we want to characterize, and Doing it on a piece of paper, we can say we add U and U dagger from the protocol that we have. Now, one thing that we can do is that we can think, from a theoretical point of view, of bringing these two Clifford gates, the one we want to estimate, the one that comes part of the protocol, together. Now, there's a property of Clifford gates that if you multiply, it belongs to a group, you multiply two of them, it gives you another Clifford gate. The Clifford gate on the measurement is just a change of basis of this measurement. So you can think about this and this and this together as making a measurement in a slightly different basis. So some zeros will be corresponding to ones. They just flip some zeros and ones in each of these bases. So this gets absorbed in one way. And so we're left with this part here, and the U twiddle is the noise with the gate that you have. So with this, we can do a very similar protocol and give be able to estimate how good we are at doing certain sets of gates. And here's an answer for, again, malonic acid. We do a set of gates, which I'll come back in a second if I have time to, the decoding of an error correcting code and see how good we are doing this. And so it's a two control knot, three gates, single qubit gates called ADAMR, and probability of doing this is 98-97%. Okay. The control that I've demonstrated here with these this algorithm cannot distinguish the error that happens while we are doing the gates and the errors in measurement and state preparation. So we have these three pieces together. And now what I'm going to show you is a way of distinguishing this. So we can find error per gate independent of the value of errors in the measurement and state preparation. And the idea, again, is to use these clever gates, make many of them, and now look at the fidelity, not at after having done one of those, but many of them. And then we make many instantiation of those, let's say 7, 13, 21 of those, and we look at which slope, the fidelity, probability of getting the right result at the end. And from this, we can estimate values of error rates. And here's error rates for different types of technologies. And when I mentioned about the improvement in control, you can see superconducting in 2009, best thing was about 1%. And today, you can get 0.08%. So 10 more minutes. You can do some similar things with two qubit gates and get errors that kind of get to about 10 minus 2, 10 minus 3 error per gate. So once we have this and we do demonstrate we have some kind of control, we can implement some implementation of error correction. So here's a very simple code which corrects for these types of error, Z errors. You take alpha 0 and beta 1, two quantum bits, you do two control knots, and then Y rotations, and that will change the state alpha 0 plus beta 1 to a state which has the form of alpha plus 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 beta minus minus, okay? And then if the errors are either nothing happens, a Z operation, a phase operation of first qubit, second qubit, or third qubit, you can easily find that it obeys that type of equation. And so you can let them evolve through the noise, you can decode, do the error correction, and what you find is a little graph of this form. And what the error correcting code here does is that it takes the error rate, epsilon, okay, error per gate, if you're not doing anything, to something which looks like C epsilon squared. C depends exactly on what the codes you have, and epsilon is a new error rate. Okay? So it tells you that if you don't do error correction, you get the red curve. If you do error correction, you see something which is a little bit flatter up here. Or if you write it, experiments that we did in the previous century, see the without error correction, we had the term first order error in terms of errors about 1 in this unit, and then we reduce it by a factor of 10. More recently, I had an undergrad student for the summer. We did exactly the same experiments, but with the better control we had developed. And you can see that things got much better in the error rate. But also, on the initial value at t is equal to zero, you can see that here we don't start at one. The reason we don't start at one is because we do errors when we do this. We do errors when we do this, and we're not at the level yet to do something which was fault tolerant. So with this, we can show that we can make some small error correcting code and see if we can go further. Going from the liquid that we had there to solid, we can do the same thing and do two rounds of error correction. If we don't do error correction, we get a curve which is in the blue here. One round of error correction, we get the red curve here, and two rounds of error correction is the black there. You can see you don't have curves here because we do two rounds of error correction. You need to do a lot more gates, and then so there's the zero time doesn't appear there, but if we wait long enough, then we can see that we can beat the two. So this shows that we have enough of the control to do error correction. But one thing I've hidden behind the carpet under here is that in nuclear magnetic resonance, we don't get really the state zero. I won't go too much in detail right now, but there's a technique of doing this, but we cannot reset them. We can do it once, but not able to reset them. So one way of resetting these qubits is in this piece called algorithmic cooling. So the idea here is, how do we take a bunch of qubits which are not in the state zero that you want? They are in a density matrix given by a certain temperature. We want to bring a few of these qubits to a state as near as possible to the zero that you want. So the first idea is maybe we can do a manipulation of these three qubits here in such a way that we cool one at the expense of heating the two others. So how do we do this? Look at the probability of these different states of being in 0, 0, 0. And let's assume here that p is small, just to simplicity. So 1 minus p is kind of relatively large. And what we want is to cool the first qubit in here. You look at the probability of getting 0, 0, 0, 1 minus p to the cube. 0, 0, 1, p times 1 minus p squared, same thing for this. And you look at 0, 1, 1, it's p squared because there's two ones here, 1 minus p. And then you go down. It's possible to cool the first qubit if you realize that this state here, 0, 1, 1, reduces the entropy of the first qubit, but its probability is smaller than the 1, 0, 0. So 1 increases the entropy of the first qubit because it's a 1 in the first qubit, but because we have 0 and 0 at the end, kind of its probability is small. So if you do a unitary transformation, which flip these two, 0, 1, 1 to 1, 0, 0, you're going to cool the first qubit at the expense of the two other, and you heat the two over there. Now, if you don't have a bath, you're stuck. You just stop there. You can ask the question of how many qubits do you need to get this one to polarization 1, or being very 0? It turns out this 1 over epsilon squared. In the liquid state of NMR, epsilon is 10 to the minus 5, so 1 over epsilon squared, we would need 10 to the 10. So we know that we'll have to want to do something else. But it is at least a path. And here's a second one, that if you have a bath, then maybe you can take these two hotter qubits than the bath, exchange them, bring them here, and do it again. And then it turns out that this gives you quite an incredible amount of efficiency. That's how it fits with a little bit of the quantum thermodynamics of Jonathan. So here's a graph of the polarization, the final polarization of the first quantum bit, okay, as a function of the polarization of the bath multiplied by 2 to the n, where we have n qubits in here. You see that when the polarization is small, when the epsilon is smaller than 2 to the power n with n qubits, the final polarization goes linearly in this log-log plot related to this. So the final polarization will be something like epsilon multiplied by 2 to the n minus 2. But when we have epsilon greater than 1 over 2 to the n, then there's a phase transition, and we get to polarization 1. In fact, we get to something which is a polarization for the first qubit, which goes like 1 minus e to the minus 2 to the power n, so double exponential in number of qubits. Okay, so we can turn this into an experiment. So we can take one of these molecules again, we can interact with the bath, and here are the experiments. The little diagram there is we get rid of the polarization of our qubits, we kind of bring it once, so we polarize that one, then we interact with the bath, we polarize the second one, and then we do the algorithm I just mentioned, and then what you get is you've gone from polarization, which was 1 to start with, to 1.39. If everything was perfect, you'd get 1.5. You do it a second time, you should get 1.75. Well, you get 1.56, and that's because our gates are not perfect. You go on. If you go to the limit, you should get to twice the initial polarization, which would be 2. But because of the errors that we have, we get to something which is 1.69. So we go and do this. Now, this we are still right now in the limit of epsilon smaller than 2 to the n. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to take one of these hydrogen there. We're going to irradiate with gamma rays and change it for an electron. So you remember the magnetic moment of the electron is about 1,000 times the one of the hydrogen. So we're going to get our polarization 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 2. And we're going to go from room temperature to liquid helium temperature, and we'll get something which is of order 1. And then we're going to transfer the polarization of this electron the same way as we've done from the hydrogen right now. And we're going to do this. And so this is something that we've started. So a bit more complicated. Up to now, we had used only commercial spectrometers. Now we have to start to build some of our piece of equipment. So for somebody who started doing quantum cosmology, it's quite an interesting thing to go to low temperature and then building our own spectrometer. But we can show that we can control with the electron there, make a control knot between two of these gates. So we can show some control in there. And more recently, we've been kind of working really hard to understand and kind of map the Hamiltonian. Because if you don't know the Hamiltonian very well, it's impossible to control. So this is where we are. So, and once we are able to polarize these qubits, we'll be able to do rounds of error correction. So that's the plan I have. So I hope by Bill's 75th birthday, we'll be going to show him rounds of error correction. And then we'll be able to demonstrate that, unfortunately, was not a prophet by saying that decoherence is going to hurt quantum computers, but he will be a heretic. Thank you.
Good. For a few questions. I thought the smallest error correcting code had 5 qubits, and you're talking about 3, if I understood right, on these molecules.
Yeah.
What am I missing there?
It's the dominant error is Z errors. If you have both X and Z, then you need to go to 5. But you have only X or only Z, you can do error correction with only. And in these systems, dephasing happens at a faster rate than bit flips. So it's.
Was this the role of what you talked about, randomizing the electron, the hydrogen spin? How did you eliminate one of the types of error?
The physics in the system gives you what is called T1 and T2 that Benny mentioned a little bit earlier on. T1 is much longer than T2. So the first step is to correct 4-phase errors. And after that, we'll have to increase qubits and correct 4T1 too. But that's our first step. That's the number one.
Actually, I have another question. This is going to maybe be an embarrassing question because it shows I didn't understand. Your piece of solid stuff has a huge number of these molecules in it, right? And
yeah.
The signal you get readout from the NMR is coming from many of them.
Yeah.
So I guess it's the point that it's like you're thinking of, you have a bunch of these quantum computers.
Yeah, and they do.
Just doing the statistics on them all at once because you're measuring them all simultaneously.
Yeah, so the induction and this coil by only one spin is so small that you cannot measure it. So we don't need these parallel quantum computers to do the quantum computation or initialization, but just to put a readout at the end. We do. So there are ideas to do this in the lab with single spins, but this method right now uses induction, so we need many of them. So we make crystals, and that's why we make dilute crystals of carbon 13 molecules compared to carbon 12. So therefore,
to normalize your results and interpret them, do you need to know exactly how many molecules are in generating your signal?
They don't talk to each other. And so there were worries in the community at some point, is this quantum or not? And the answer is, if you want to explain this classically, you typically need an exponential amount of resources somewhere to make these spins behave the way they should.
But that's scaling exponentially slow the signal with the number of qubits you have in,
No, the signal is proportional to the number of qubits.
No, if you want to treat the 10 qubit signal system or 20 qubits, and sure, the full mass is the full volume will give you a louder signal, but if you want to treat a louder system in the effective wave function, I guess that the signal will decay because you have to distinguish between very closely separated energy levels. So how does it depend on the size of the system?
Not with algorithmic cooling.
Oh, okay.
So if you use algorithmic cooling, you don't have that problem. So if you use a liquid and in the regime where epsilon is much smaller than 2n, then what people had done in the past was to, instead of starting with states which are really zeros, they start with a state which is 1 minus epsilon of this form. And these things are called pseudo-pure states. Now, from a quantum computation point of view, if you do unitary transformation only, unitary transformation is effectless. So it transformed the state the right way. But to prepare those, the way that people were doing when they started to do NMR was exponentially hard. Or in many of the experiments that we do, it is that way. Like in the liquid state experiments that I mentioned, with this large molecule with 12 qubits, where do I have it? With this one here. And if I want to prepare a state that way, then I get 1 over 2 to the 12 of the signal. But you can still see things. Hard, but it's okay. And with 12, you learn now to control larger quantum systems.
So how far can it's expected to go in this
semester? So in the liquid,
it's like 10 years to go in terms of the number of qubits.
So in the liquid, we'll probably stop around 10 to 20. With the cooling, so there is a proposal to go to 100 within about 5 years.
And controlling separate
nuclear spin. So it's a combination of the electrons and the nucleus.
Then you beat the ions.
People in the ions are planning to get 100 qubits in 5 years, and
yeah,
the superconducting.
They're always just for two single ions rather than two single ions in there. And there are always that you mentioned, which are very good.
I think we should have the photos sort of waiting. We can continue this. Before we thank the speaker again, let's provide, we will now do the photo, and then there will be the perfect thing. So let's